Welcome to your commercial-free, uninterrupted investment show, sponsored by the SEC-registered investment firm, Wilsey Asset Management, a fiduciary firm owned and operated by President Brent Wilsey, who has been putting clients' investment needs first for over 40 years. The Smart Investing Show has been giving unbiased financial information for over 27 years on local radio stations right here in San Diego, providing you with fundamental analysis on stocks and investments you want to know about. Now, here are your hosts, Brent and Chase Wilsey.
Well, hello and welcome to the Smart Investing Show. I'm Brent Wilsey, president of Wilsey Asset Management. Great to have you here at the Smart Investing Show. We got a lot of things to talk about today. Well, on Friday, we had a jobs report. We're going to talk about the jobs report. Also attached to that comes out earlier in the week is the JOLTS report, stands for Job Opening Labor Turnover Survey. China, we're going to discuss China because things are kind of crazy there. I want to bring you up to speed what's going on with China and how it could affect us here in the U.S. And then also to personal consumption is what the Fed looks at. Talks about inflation. We're going to go over that. And with me, back from his having his baby, is Chase. Chase, how you doing?
Good. Good to be here. You know, it's been a fun week and, you know, cool. I had a little leap day baby, but, you know, got to get back to work. You know?
Yes. Back to work. And you sleeping very much?
Actually, not too bad. Yeah, I'm kind of jumping ahead here, but we're going to look at Starbucks. I don't know if you picked that one because you thought I might need some coffee from the lack of sleep I'm getting. But no, she's actually been a saint. I've been getting like 6 hours of sleep a night, which is pretty good from what I hear.
Well, that means your second one's going to be a terrible one. We won't worry about that for now.
Well, before we get into the topics you discussed, I talked about Starbucks. As always, we like to pick some companies here, break down the fundamentals, look at the debt levels, look at the valuations of the businesses, and give you our opinion on if it's a buy, sell, maybe it's a hold. So, like I said, we're going to look at Starbucks. Also, going to look at Alphabet. You know, a lot of the Magnificent Seven, some of them haven't been so magnificent. Some of them have been more magnificent this year. Alphabet's one that has been a little bit left behind to start 2024. Thought we'd take a closer look there. Also, Norwegian Cruise Line Holdings. Cruising obviously got decimated during COVID. Looks like some of the stocks have made a little bit of a comeback, so curious to see what those numbers look like. And also, too, Palo Alto Networks, cybersecurity company. I know they got crushed after earnings, and their competitor, CrowdStrike, actually did okay. So very curious as to what's going on at Palo Alto. Maybe that dip created a buying opportunity in a company that I think could potentially have a bright future, as we know cybersecurity is going nowhere.
<laughs> <laughs> We'll take a look at those. So, all right, well, let's get right into the labor market because, again, we keep talking about the strong job market. And while the headline number of 275,000 jobs created easily topped the estimate of 198,000 and sparked concerns the labor market remained too hot, the details of the report showed a much softer labor market. Now, to begin, the prior 2 months saw a downward revision of 167,000 jobs, which is more than offsets the beat we saw in the month of February. Also, while I generally am a little more skeptical of the household survey, it did show a decline of 184,000 in those that were counted as employed, which led to an uptick in the employment rate to 3.9%. This was above the estimate of 3.7%.
And I did want to just kind of go back real quick. The reason we're a little skeptical of the household survey, I like the establishment survey because they look more at businesses and ask them what's going on with their payrolls, where the household survey is like, hey, are you employed? No. Do you want a job? Yeah. Okay. Unemployed. <You know? laughs> So I'm generally a little more skeptical of that, but you know, it's still good to look at all the data and kind of look at it in conjunction with one another. I did also want to point out, though, a little disappointed to see that government remained a large contributor in the establishment survey as the sector added 52,000 jobs. They lagged a little bit in COVID, but gosh, it seems like they've really remained quite strong in adding jobs, which honestly shows a little bit more that the private market may not be as strong as, again, that headline number indicated. But outside of government, other areas that were strong included healthcare and social assistance, up 90,700. Leisure and hospitality, that was up 58,000. Also, too, construction, up 23,000. We know that there's still, I'm going to say, more headway from the Inflation Reduction Act, kind of the CHIPS Act. We think construction still has some room to go in being a contributor in this economy. Also, wage gains were a bright spot in the report as average hourly earnings increased 4.3% compared to last year. This was below the estimate of 4.4% and also below last month's reading of 4.5%. I do believe this report continues to put us on track for 3 to 4 rate cuts that we've been talking about. But again, that's going to come in the back part of this year. I say that, gosh, it's already March. June's going to be here before we know it. I guess we'll find out if we're right or wrong.
and this report was good for that because it was too strong. You may not see the rate cuts until maybe later summer, but I think we will see them June, July is when I'll see those rate cuts. And it's going to be, I'm still on the board of three rate cuts, which will be enough to, I believe, stabilize the economy. And one thing, too, if they start too late reducing rates, they could push it into inflation in 2025. So that's why it's so important to time this right. And I think so far they've been pretty much on doing it right. And on that jobs thing for the government, unfortunately, government is growing. We see all this money coming in and all the government jobs. I do want to point out that's not just the federal government. That's federal, state, local, municipalities, many different things. I don't think the federal government's just raising their employers.
Yeah, and it also includes things like teachers. So, it's not just like, oh, my gosh, all these admin positions and God knows we need more teachers.
We need more teachers, probably less admin positions, but we won't talk about that right now. So let's move on because we do want to talk about the JOLTS report. And we always talk about these two together because it does tie into the labor market. And again, JOLTS stands for Job Opening Labor Turnover Survey. The January Job Openings and Labor Turnover Survey, JOLTS, was right in line with expectations with the previous month as job openings totaled 8.9 million. This remains well below the high of 12.2 million in March of 2022, but is still well above the historical norms as pre-pandemic. We have not seen a reading above 8 million. I continue to believe job openings will continue to trend lower to come back in line with historic levels. This does not mean we believe we are seeking a weak labor market, but I would call it a normalizing labor market. We've also seen a normalization in quits, which should be a positive for wage pressures. Quits in the month were 3.4 million.
Now, this compares to annual quits of 44.4 million or 3.7 million per month in 2023. So again, a little downtick there. Also looking at total quits in 2023, well, they fell by 6.1 million when compared to 2022. So again, we're seeing quits reduce there. Looking at pre-pandemic levels, quits did total 42.1 million in 2019, which would have been an average of 3.5 million. So again, puts us again right around those pre-pandemic levels. Also, too, we've talked about this before, but layoffs, you know, they were also strong as they totaled just 1.6 million. I say strong as in they weren't overly egregious. There wasn't a ton of layoffs or were than historic levels. Not like strong as in we had a ton of layoffs. I will say as well, this layoff amount was right in line with 2023 levels, as for the full year, they totaled 19.8 million and averaged 1.65 million per month. And in 2019, layoffs totaled 21.7 million and averaged 1.8 million per month. Again, I'm going to say it again, 2019, 1.8 million per month was the average. We're at 1.6 million in January here. So again, people are like, oh my gosh, there's all these layoffs in big tech. Again, not outside the norms, especially in 2019, people thought the economy was doing quite well. I did want to just point out and provide all this data to show the labor market may be softening from strong levels, but I believe there is still some room to have numbers normalize without tilting us into a weak labor market. This could mean a little bit higher layoffs, less job openings, maybe less quits to get us back in line with, again, a normal labor market. Right now, the way the labor market has been acting is not normal. It's too strong.
And Chase, it's so important to focus on the layoffs because people keep saying, oh, you don't get it. The market's going to crash because they're laying people off. And you've got to have a baseline. That's why we spend so much time doing our research. The average person watches the evening news or reads something on the paper and says, oh, see all these layoffs, you know, the economy's going to crash. You've got to look at the data. That's why you do the Smart Investing Show to make you a smarter investor. And when you compare to 2019, remember how strong the economy was in 2019. Everyone was happy and this is great. We now have less layoffs than 2019 when the economy was great. So please understand what's going on here.
Well, it's funny when you actually think about it. I'm trying to think of examples here. I know like one of the recent ones was Paramount laid off 800 people. 800 out of 1.6 million, or Microsoft, I think, laid off 10,000.
Yeah.
And oh my gosh, 10,000 people. But it's all relative. Again, you look at 10,000 compared to 1.6 million.
Yeah.
That doesn't even move the needle hardly.
Right.
I mean, people forget about small and mid-sized businesses that aren't part of the Fortune 500 that maybe aren't laying anybody off. And maybe they're scooping up those people from Microsoft that say, hey, that's a good talent opportunity. We'll bring them on in. I mean, it's really not as problematic as, again, the mainstream media makes it out to be.
And this is the data that we use to manage our clients' portfolios and why we have very good, I want to say performance for lack of a better term, because of the fact that we don't make mistakes and panic emotionally. And we've had people, I'm getting out of the market because you don't get it. You know, people are laying off, the economy is crumbling. It's like, no, it's not. You've got to look at the data. You can't just, and again, we do this on a daily basis. You can't look at one thing and make a decision on that. You have to stay with it and realize that as long as we have a good jobs market, people will spend money. And that's the important part is look at the numbers and not just one or two things. We look at many things. So that's, again, why I do the smart investing.
You can always find one negative out there. If you're looking for a negative, you can find it.
Well, and we talked years ago, probably 3-4 years ago, about China. China's going to be a problem. Well, let's talk about what happened to China. The country had such a robust economy just a few short years ago, but the writing was on the wall. Here are the problems that caused the economic downfall. A real estate boom, which accounted for 25% of China's annual economic output. The debt and inventory continued to rise in houses and condos, but many remained empty with no one able to buy them. And we talked about all this years ago that this was going to happen.
The ghost towns.
Yeah, the ghost towns. And the government cut off the debt to developers, which ended the real estate boom. Consumers who did buy into expensive real estate housing market in China leveraged beyond their means with the expectation that the growth would continue and they could sell out with a profit. Unfortunately, they are now sitting underwater in much of their real estate, but still have to pay the debt and don't have much discretionary income to spend in other parts of the economy. China is now experiencing deflation, which will give them negative growth in parts of their economy for perhaps years to come.
China's overall debts have now surpassed 300% of GDP. And we've talked about this here in the U.S., and gosh, I think we're like 100 and I want to say around 120%, or that's maybe where we've been coming out of COVID. China's at 300%. Now, people worry about our debt. Look at that. That is a huge, more than twice the amount that we have here. And also, too, they have very little chance of the economy growing to pay down that debt. And also, too, no GDP growth, high debt levels. That debt to GDP is only continue to increase. Also, too, want to point out, many years ago, they put a cap on how many babies people could have, and now that is hurting them with an aging workforce and also, too, a shrinking workforce. I do not know why they did that. That makes no sense at all. I mean, now you have old people that, especially you look at, you know, Social Security here, how is the workforce supposed to take care of people that are retired? It makes no sense. It will take years for the country to reverse, you know, that policy that they had made. In the meantime, the economy, well, it remains underwater. Since 1998, foreign investment in China has always been on the upswing, but that run came to an end in the third quarter of 2023 as foreign companies sold out and left, or they just stopped investing in China. There is nothing left to build in China when looking at their infrastructure. They have built many roads, railroads, airports, so there will be no future investment in infrastructure either. That was a huge growth catalyst for them for many, many years as well. The thing that it all really boils down to at the end of the day is China has always been a communist country, and I just frankly don't think they really understood capitalism very well. An economy will always go through the ups and downs, but the United States has been around for 200 years, and we have learned some valuable lessons like 1929, 2008, very difficult time periods, but again, we got through them. While we can't avoid the downturns, we have definitely learned how to minimize the depths of those downturns.
And Chase, I brought this up because it's so important to understand. Well, first of all, we're concerned on China. And I did write another post that will be in the newsletter. I think it'll be in this week or next week about they're still spending a lot on their military. But it still doesn't come close. I think it was like they're spending $200 billion. I think we spend $800 billion. So there's things you have to look at to understand because people worry about, oh, China taking over this. And I have worried about that. But I look at these numbers saying we're still in a good position. And you have to keep looking at it because if you don't, you take your eye off the ball, you can be blindsided. But China, good example. And I really believe because they were a communist country, they did not understand capitalism. They didn't understand how it works. And we've dealt with it for over 200 years. I don't want to say imperfected, but we know how to do things. We had a great time with Alan Greenspan during the 2000, he was around the tech boom and bust. Bernanke, he was around the Great Recession there. So we've learned how to manage through that. And China was just, you know, again, building all the real estate they did and who's going to buy it. They didn't think about this stuff. And so it's important that we learn lessons from that.
I mean, it's one reason we have never gone investing into China because of that communist nature. You can't really fathom what the government's going to do to these businesses. And, you know, that's where capitalism's so strong. That's why I'm so grateful to have the companies that we have here. That's what really, frankly, gets us through the difficult time periods is the businesses that we have here, the stock market that we have here. And the only way to replicate the success that we've had is actually through true capitalism like we have here in the U.S. I say true capitalism. There is still, obviously, some regulatory burdens that I'm going to say are necessary, sometimes go overboard, but you know, you need that kind of balance there, and capitalism is really what I think has made this country so great.
And it's so important that, too, I mean, and I know our government's crazy. We have a lot of crazy things there, but it's still the best in the world. And you're going to see crazy things that happen with the Democrats or the Republicans, but the system overall does work, and that's why we can continue to invest looking at how these things work. And let's move on, because I know we're spending quite a bit of time here, but I do want to talk about the personal consumption expenditures, because this talks about inflation. The personal consumption expenditures, the price index known as PCE, it is the main inflation gauge that the Federal Reserve looks at, came in with a good inflation number. Excluding food and energy, the change from 1 year ago for January was 2.8%, which shows a nice downward trend from December 2023, of 2.9%, November 2023 at 3.2%, then October 2023 was at 3.4%. The numbers are going the right direction, but they are now falling a little more slowly than the big jumps we had before.
I still believe by the end of the year, we should be at that 2% target, which is the Fed's target, and they should start reducing rates again by mid-year, as we've discussed. Even though they won't be at that 2% level by June or July, they need to start reducing rates a little bit to prevent a recession in 2025. At Wilson Asset Management, we do believe the Federal Reserve came to the rescue to reduce inflation a little bit too late, but now they have done a good job on managing the economy. Continue to believe that the Federal Reserve will do a good job in 2024, but stay tuned as we'll be on top of it each month as this data is released. And I know next week, I think we get CPI and PPI, which, you know, are different inflation readings. And frankly, the January readings for CPI and PPI were, I'm going to say, quite different than the PCE.
Yeah,
and they were. It kind of spooked the market a little bit when the CPI and PPI came out, but then this PCE number, I mean, at 2.8% is really not that bad.
And that's why I keep saying by the summertime, I think we'll see PCE around 2.4, 2.5, not at the 2% target, but they got to start doing it soon, because they wait till 2%, they could go into recession. So that's why I think that'll happen in the summertime. A lot of people agree with me on that. All this information comes from our newsletter called the Smart Investing Newsletter. It is free at our website. Go to the website, smartinvesting2000.com. And we got some other great topics in there. We talk about mega cap stocks, Apple products in China. You got to read that, because it kind of dovetails to what we talked about China. Bitcoin hitting highs. We're going to talk about that more to understand what's going on. And also, too, Elon Musk and OpenAI. These are things you'll get at the newsletter. It is free. Again, go to our website, smartinvesting2000.com. Again, that's smartinvesting2000.com. Right in the middle of the page, when you go there, you'll see a newsletter. Click on there, sign up for it. You'll love it. A lot of people get it like, wow, you got a lot of great information here. That's what we try to do, is educate people investing-wise.
Sometimes it's so hard when we look at our topics to discuss on the radio show, because, again, it comes from the newsletter, the topics there. It's like, oh, man, but we didn't get to talk about this, this, and this. So that's why I got to sign up for the newsletter, because we don't get to cover all those topics on the radio show every week here.
Yep. And also the great topics is always our financial planner, Harrison Johnson. Harrison, you with us this morning?
I am. How you guys doing?
Good, good. I like the topic today, and it's just like, I didn't think it ever changes, but you're talking about Social Security changes coming. What changes are coming in Social Security here?
Well, the State of the Union was this last week, and one of President Biden's talking points was Social Security, and he stated, working people who built this country pay more into Social Security than millionaires and billionaires do, so he vowed to make the wealthy pay their fair share. Now, it's true that if you're a millionaire or a billionaire and you don't have wages or self-employment income because your income comes from investment income or real estate income or something like that, you don't pay into Social Security. Social Security taxes are only based on wages and self-employment. So in some cases, working class people actually do pay more into Social Security, but they're also the only ones who receive Social Security. So if you have income where you don't pay into Social Security, you're not entitled to receive it in retirement. However, for the people who do pay into Social Security, the benefits are subsidized by high wage earners and business owners for the benefit of low-income earners, and that's an objective fact. It's indisputable. So as an employee, 6.2% of your wages are withheld for Social Security up to a cap of $168,600 of wages. The Social Security benefit amount that you get is based on 35 years of earnings, and they average that out to get an average monthly earnings amount. Your full retirement age amount is then the sum of 90% of the first $1,174 of your average monthly earnings, 32% of the next $5,904, and then 15% of any monthly earnings you have above that. So for example, if you're someone who makes $50,000 per year, your full retirement age amount is going to be just over $2,000 a month in retirement, which is about 48% of your earnings. Now, if you're someone who makes $150,000 per year, your Social Security would be around $3,759 per month, which is only 30% of your earnings. So even though you're both paying the same 6.2% of your income into Social Security, that lower earner is going to receive a much larger percent of their income back in the form of benefits. In the case of business owners have to pay double the tax for a total of 12.4% because they are considered both an employee and an employer at the same time, and they have to pay another 6.2% for all their employees. So a business owner is really paying more into Social Security than all their employees combined. In regards to making the wealthy pay their fair share, there's been proposed bills that would tax earnings over $250,000, over $400,000, or possibly tax investment income. However, it's unclear if these additional taxes would then change the potential benefit amount of those people paying those taxes, or if those extra taxes would just go to benefit the lower wage earners. There's no doubt that the Social Security system itself needs some adjustments, but we need to understand the facts before we can implement change to it.
And Harrison, that this all makes sense, unfortunately, that they want to raise more money. But the thing I always look at, too, is the benefits seem so liberal for people. I mean, if it seems like if you worked for a couple of years, it used to be you could collect Social Security. I mean, there's so many times they give out Social Security, like, well, gosh, it just didn't seem that they should benefit from that. I think there's too many benefits from Social Security as opposed to just being retired and collecting Social Security.
Well, that's kind of the point. It's the more that you pay into it, the less back you get in terms of how much you're paying into it. And so if you're making the argument that, well, we need to make wealthy people pay their fair share, you're kind of getting away from the whole point of Social Security. The whole point of Social Security is you pay money into it and then you get money back on an individual basis. So if we go to taxing certain types of people and then using that money to benefit somebody else, you know, that's not really the purpose. And if we're going to do that, we might as well just dissolve the Social Security system as a whole and create a universal basic income and increase taxes on everybody else to pay for it, because that's kind of the direction that'd be going.
And bite your tongue on that. We don't want that.
I'm being facetious because I don't think that's a good idea. Right. But, you know, when you're making the argument of, oh, we need to make certain people pay more taxes into it, again, the more you pay into it as an individual, the more you get out of it. So if you're going to tax people more but have those people not benefit for it and then have other people greatly or more benefit from that, you know, we're kind of getting away from, you know, how this is calculated, which, again, the amount that you get is based on your own earnings history. The more you work, the more you pay into it. That's what's determined. So, again, we can make these arguments of, oh, you know, we need to increase taxes, we need to cut benefits, we need to do all these things. But, you know, before we're making changes, we need to understand how it actually works.
And I know it used to be, too, that, and I think this has changed. I think you said something about 35 years it was based on the earnings. I think it used to be years ago, like they'd based on the last 12 quarters or something. So if you were a foreigner, you come in here and you work for 12 quarters, you can collect Social Security. Have they changed those rules, made it a little more difficult, or no?
So the way that it works is to qualify to get anything, you have to work for 10 years or 40 quarters. So if you work for 40 quarters, you can get something, but the amount is still going to be based on 35 years of earnings. So if you work for 10 years, you know, your average monthly earnings is going to be low because you're going to have 25 years of no earnings. And that's going to bring, you know, your average down, which means you're not going to get as much. Where if you work for 35 years or more, well, now you've got earnings in every single year. So your average monthly amount is going to be higher, which, you know, is going to increase the amount that you get.
I did want to say just real quick, too, is, you know, we're not a political show, but, you know, it is important to kind of understand these things, especially Social Security, kind of how it works, because it doesn't impact your retirement. But also, too, is just, I just get so frustrated with these buzzwords, tax the rich aren't paying their fare, and they don't, like, have any, like, proof of any, and the Republicans do it as well. It's just buzzwords without any substantial evidence of anything. So it's just, you know, when you're looking at things this November, I mean, make sure you don't just read the headlines, look at the buzzwords, because you're not going to make an informed decision at the end of the day.
And we're not a political show, but again, this is important because this money that the government takes away from an investment into the economy.
That's true.
So anything else, Harrison?
I was not trying to be political on this. I was you know, looking at some of the comments in the State of the Union, and if you're looking at taxes as a whole, like federal taxes, state income taxes, stuff like that, you know, that's kind of where you can get political and make the claim, oh, well, you know, certain groups are not paying their fair share or whatever. But Social Security is a totally different thing. It's based on, you know, who's paying into it, and that determines what you get out. So if we get too far removed from that and treat Social Security just as another federal income tax, you know, that's, we're getting away from the whole purpose of it. And again, there, at that point, there's no difference than just getting rid of the system as a whole and increasing taxes across the board and, you know, giving everyone the same amount of income, which is, you know,
exactly
not what we want.
Not what we want at all.
Well,
Harrison, yes, thank you very much. We'll see you on Monday, and you have a great great day there. Again, as Harrison Johnson, he is our financial planner. He's a CFP. He's on a salary. It's a fee-based planning. He's not going to try to sell you any commission products. If you want a free consultation with him, give him a call at the office at 858-224-0004. Again, that's 858-224-0004. Or go to the website. Very easy to find him there. SmartInvesting2000.com. That is SmartInvesting2000.com. All right, we kind of pushed up towards a break here. We are going to be talking about Starbucks. SBUX is their symbol in the restaurant industry. There is the music. I knew the music was going to come up and cut me off. We're going to hit that when we come back. I'm going to talk about the fundamentals of it, the evaluation ratios, growth rates. Chase, you're going to hit the earnings.
Yeah, earnings, target sell price, current price levels, Dewick range. So excited to cover that when we come back from the break.
All right, stay with us. Smart Investing Show with Brent Chase. We'll be right back. Alrighty, welcome back to the Smart Investing Show. It is now time of the show where you look at some important equities, companies as we call them, for you to maybe look at investing in, or maybe hold them, maybe time to consider selling those. But we're going to go over some companies here that are in the news that we think are very important to maybe invest in or maybe look at selling there. We're going to start off with Starbucks, where the steam is seen to have left Starbucks here. And I know, Chase, you're going to give us some time frame, but I think it's been a couple of years since the stock has moved. Let's take a look at Starbucks. Their symbol is SBUX. They're doing the industry of restaurants. Not much float on that as far as the short goes, 1.2%. Only 76% institutional owned. They do have a high PE of 24.4, but not as high as the industry at 28.3. Price of sales 2.9, above the industry at 2.7. They have no price to book value or tangible book value, which means if you take away all the liabilities, there's no value to this company. Price of cash flow 15.4, better than the industry at 17.8. And PEG ratio, which tells what you're paying for future growth, 1.4. versus 5.7, so that is good. Now, they have seen their earnings grow 29.9% over last year. Very good, but the industry is up 59.5%, and sales I hope I did say earnings were up 29.9, but sales were up 11.5% over the past year, which is better than the sales in the industry at 4.6. The analysts still love it. They say 5 years down the road, we're looking for earnings to grow by about 16%, so that's positive above the industry at 12. They do pay a 2.5% dividend, use 58% of their earnings to pay that out. I'm kind of surprised it's that high for 2.5% dividend. We do see on the balance sheet, current ratio is 0.7 versus 1.1. Now, that's pretty low. Now, there could be some franchising thing going on. Something's strange, but I do want to put a warning sign on that. We like to have the current ratio around at least 0.8 to 1 or so. Debt to equity, no equity. So you have to look at the balance sheet to see what the debt that they have at Starbucks. And then a net profit margin, 11.7. And return on equity, a negative 49.8. You like to see a positive. We like to see it around 15% or so. Chase, what do you got going forward?
Yeah, so current price here for Starbucks, it's $91.06. Again, their ticker symbol is SBUX. 52-week range, I see, gosh, the low here, $89.21. So definitely closer to the low because the high here for the 52-week is $115.48. And as I said, I did go back a little bit further. Over the last 5 years, the stock's up about 31%, which is, I'm going to say, okay. But you look back, they actually topped out back in, it looks like July, August of 2021 at above $125 a share. So, I mean, they're still well off that high that they hit just a few years ago. So Starbucks stock has definitely been, I'm going to say, lagging here. Now, what I'm going to look at, too, going forward for Starbucks, we're going to go out to, looks like they do report on a fiscal basis rather than a calendar year. So I go out to September 2025. I do see estimated earnings per share here of $4.73. It gives us a target sell price, unfortunately, of $78.52. So still below that current price of $91.06. So it looks like Starbucks, it just got way too far ahead of itself. And now it's just kind of almost essentially trading flat for the last few years.
And I think Starbucks is a good business. They're just priced rather richly. And I do see over the last 9 days, the earnings estimates going forward to October 2025 are down about 2.3%. But I see headwinds that they're facing. And two that come to my mind are, first off, the unions. I've seen the unions try to get in there, and I think that would destroy their business model because they're hard workers in there. And they do a great job making a cup of coffee, a frappuccino, whatever, fancy coffee.
A latte.
Latte, there we go, thank you. And the unions, I'm afraid, would kind of slow that down. And then the other headwind I see them facing is China. They got a lot of stores in China.
Yeah, I know. I haven't followed Starbucks that closely, but I do know, like, a few years ago they talked about China's this big growth engine, and I'm not sure if that's materializing or not. It could actually be hurting them. I was going to say, kind of to that point about growth, I am surprised this year they're looking for earnings growth about 14.7%.
That's pretty high.
And then next year also to earnings growth for 2025 about 16.5%. I don't know where that earnings growth could come from. I mean, you have union pressure, labor prices are going to go up. Frankly, they have stores everywhere. So, I was thinking, it's funny, the Starbucks by my house is over in Albertsons off in Rancho Bernardo. They have the Albertsons that has Starbucks, and then right outside Albertsons, they have a Starbucks right there, too. And it's just like, I've never understood that. So I don't see how they could grow from more locations. I don't know where that earnings growth would come from unless they have a massive stock buyback program or raw materials like the cocoa beans or whatever they use to create coffee is coming down.
And I like a Starbucks once in a while, kind of like a treat and stuff, like, okay, I'll have a Starbucks, but I'm not a regular drinker of it. I know a lot of people are, but again, how are you going to keep growing that market? And again, I think the market in China has really been stagnated. I don't know if they're growing other places in the world. Did you get to look at a graph of where they've been for that? Because I think they've been almost flat for the last few years, and I'm hoping that their earnings have grown because maybe this could be down the road, maybe a value play, but we'd have to have the earnings go up dramatically or the stock pull back. What was the target sell price you came up with?
I said it was around 79.
Around 79. Have to have some big changes.
Well, like I said, I did point out the last few years that the stock is down from 125 to 91. So it's just not. It's essentially traded nowhere for the last 3 years.
Yeah, and I just,
and I think the next couple years, the same thing could happen, or perhaps it even goes lower.
Yeah, that could be a very.
I mean, it's expensive, so I just. I would definitely rate Starbucks a sell at these levels.
Yeah. Again, I like a Starbucks once in a while. I like it, but I'm not going to invest in the company because it's just, I think they have a tough road ahead of them for at least next couple of years.
Well, actually, I haven't had coffee in about 10 months. So
coffee or Starbucks?
Coffee. Starbucks, I think the last time I had it was probably about 7 months ago. I had little egg bites.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And I'm like, I like the Starbucks, but I just go into my office, I make the coffee with the packets there, and then you get this flavored creamer. Tastes pretty good, and it costs me, what, 50 cents? I don't know. And I'm not a big coffee drinker either. You had no coffee in a year?
Yeah.
Wow, congratulations. Wow. All right, well, let's move on. I know we got Robert coming up pretty soon, but let's move on and talk about Alphabet, Google. I still call it Google because that's the name it's been forever for me, because they've had some problems as well. I'm thinking maybe this is time that this growth company has gone into a value company. Their symbol is G-O-O-G, still the old Google the name there. Internet Connect and Information, Content and Information is what they are. No shares float, only 62% institutional owned. P.E. ratio 23.5 versus 24.6. That is below the S&P 500, by the way, which is impressive. Price to sales 5.6 versus 5.8. Price to book value 6.7, well below the industry at 41.1. And then price to cash flow is 17.1 versus 17.9. That's a positive. And the PEG ratio 1.1 versus 6.2, another positive there. They have grown their earnings over the last year by 27.2%. The industry's up 88.4. That probably includes somebody like NVIDIA or something else in there that have such a high growth on their earnings over the last year. Sales for Google were up 8.7 versus 16.6. And excuse me if I still call it Google, not Alphabet. You know what I mean. 5-year growth rate is 19.3. The industry's at 19.9. They do not pay a dividend. Look at their balance sheet. Current ratio 2.1 versus 2.4. That's good. Debt to equity still low, 0.1 versus 0.2. Net profit margin is very good for Google, Alphabet, 24% versus 22.5. And return on equity, 26 versus 25.8. Chase, what do you got going forward?
Yeah, so looking at the current price here for Alphabet, it's $136. $136.31, and I'm looking, there's two share classes, so I'm looking at, just for simplicity, G-O-O-G. Ultimately, the fundamentals will still be the same, whether you're looking at G-O-O-G or G-O-O-G-L, but the stock price may be a little bit different. So that's what I'm looking at here currently. 52-week range, the low $89.94, and the high $155.20. Just kind of looking year-to-date, you know, as I said, there's some Magnificent Seven stocks that aren't so magnificent. This is one of them. Year-to-date, they're down about 3%. I mean, not bad, but, you know, not as exciting as NVIDIA, which is up, I think, like 90% now. looking at going forward for, again, Alphabet, going to December 2025, I do see estimated earnings per share here, $7.82. What gives a target sell price? I'm going to say, unfortunately, of $129.81. So it still trades at a forward PE multiple over 17 times. I'm a little bit surprised by this because I did see a Oakmark gentleman who's a value investor talking about that they do own Alphabet, and I was hoping that maybe this would be an opportunity, but it's relative to the other Magnificent Seven. Yeah, trading at 17 times earnings is a value, but it's still, over history, I wouldn't call it a great value.
And I know they do have, I think, some lawsuits against them, and they're having, like, with their Google search, which has been a big thing for many, many years. They're saying that AI is going to take that away from them with, I think, Bing, the Copilot.
There's other players. Yeah.
So they've got some competition there, which is good because it makes things better, but it could hurt their earnings. And again, their earnings over the last 9 days, they're about the same, I think down 0.4% or something. So I think it's worth watching this. Again, I see problems with them down the road that could cause that stock to fall further, creating that value opportunity to get in and buy it on sale.
And I will say, too, the difficult thing about Alphabet is they have so many other businesses as well. You know, they have Search, which is, I'm going to say, the big money maker, but they have YouTube as well, which has made good money for them. They have the Waymo branch. I mean, they have the cloud business. So, I mean, they have all these different companies within Alphabet. So it's a little bit more complicated of a business to understand than, I'm going to say, like a food company where you're just, right, you know, buying and selling something, different products. It's more complex. But I think it's a good company. I think that, you know, they're competing in good spaces. I think they have the right assets, but it's still just a little expensive for our liking.
Yeah, and we are true value investors. We don't like to overpay for things and say, yeah, And there is a greater fool theory where it says if you buy at this price, hopefully there's a greater fool theory to buy at a higher price. We want to be the guy that buys at the low price. And maybe we don't buy at the absolute bottom. You don't know where that is. But we want to get it on sale and say where it'll be 2, 3, 4 years down the road.
Yeah.
So, all righty. You know, it's time to talk about real estate and mortgages. For that, we turn to our mortgage real estate expert, Robert B. Hick, president of Countywide Mortgage Lending. Robert, how are you doing this morning?
Good morning, gentlemen. How are you?
We're doing great. I know today you're talking about the good and the bad of buying a condo. You know, I've thought about this, but I don't know the details, so let me listen to you and see what you say.
You know, the biggest thing that baffles me is that when I talk to folks, they don't understand when they buy a condo that they own the airspace within the four walls.
The airspace. Well, you better describe that a little bit.
So the airspace is when you buy a condo, and let's say there are 50 of them, you own 150 of the complex. You own 150 of the pool, the roof, the stairs, and the space within your four walls. Everything else belongs to the homeowners association, and you have a homeowners association dues that pays for manicuring, keeping up, and taking care of all the other things.
Well, that could be a good and a bad thing, right?
It absolutely is. If your neighbors are remodeling their condos and they're keeping the project up, your value is going to come up. But it'll also do the same if they're not.
And I believe because you don't own the land. This is one thing I try to tell people, that with real estate, what really appreciates the land, because you technically have a depreciating asset on the land. And if with a condo, and yes, they will appreciate, but not as much as a house could. I guess they're kind of tied to it, because really a house does depreciate. It starts falling apart. I mean, 100 years down the road, you got to replace by the plumbing, everything else. So what is your thoughts on that? Do they appreciate as much as a house does? I mean, they kind of have to keep in some uniform.
That's a great point, and they're great for starting out, right? For what you're getting a bunch of amenities that you necessarily wouldn't with a single family house. Granite countertops, maybe a pool, a workout room, all those other kinds of things that you wouldn't with a starter home. So they do depreciate. That's why you get a tax write-off. But for somebody who's getting started, they're a great stepping stone just to get in and get things going.
And are the mortgages different on them than they are on a house, or the same deal there?
They're absolutely the same, except some condominium projects are not FHA approved. And then, so if they're not approved, then you can't get all the options of financing that you would on a home.
Do you have any recommendations around looking at the HOA? I mean, I know I've had friends where they buy a condo because they want to get into real estate, and all of a sudden they didn't look at the HOA. And I mean, you don't really have any control over what the HOA does, and they're going to hike your rates pretty quickly, right?
Well, what's happened as of late is because of fire insurance. A lot of the homeowners associations, just like homes, weren't counting on the insurance crises. And so the insurance has gone up quite a bit, and that's a big cost to the homeowners association to pay for fire against all those types of things that are going out there. But I would always suggest, and it's one of the things we do with our clients, is we look through the budget, just like anything. If they haven't been collecting enough, if there's not enough money in reserves, those are red flags. And we need to look at that always as we get into shopping for a condo.
So, Robert, do you help somebody on that where they say, oh, I just love this condo, it's great, and so forth, and you look into it saying, you know what, this has got problems down the road because the association is not collecting enough money. Do you do that for your clients?
Have to. Absolutely. It is a viable part of what we do. And there's more and more of the condo complexes are getting better at it. But as Chase was saying, they have seen the homeowners association fee, which is a big part of buying a condo, go up.
Wow. So important. I mean, I'm sure a lot of mortgage brokers out there, they just want to do the loan. But what you do at Countywide Mortgage Lending is you actually spend the time to make sure you're taking care of your client. Is that correct?
It's absolutely the bottom line.
Great.
Got to make sense.
Got to make sense. Well, Robert, thank you very much. And, you know, and I don't have the best website for you. I think you have an easier website than when I give out. Can you give that out to us real quick?
It's countywidemtg.com. Countywidemtg.com.
That is much easier. Well, Robert, thank you very much. You have a great weekend, and we'll talk more next week.
Have a great one, guys. Chase, get some sleep.
Appreciate it.
Or drink some coffee. Take care.
All right, bye-bye. Again, that is Robert Behick, president of Countywide Mortgage Lending. You can call him directly on his cell phone, 760-443-3821. Again, that's 760-443-3821. And Robert is one of the top 100 mortgage companies in America since 2012. And Robert is one of the top 1% producing loan officers in the country. So when you call him on cell phone, you're pretty lucky. Again, 760-443-3821. Or go to the website countywidemtg.com.
And just a reminder here, Countywide Mortgage Lending is a division of Golden Empire Mortgage, Inc., NMLS number 1104585, licensed by the Department of Financial Protection and Innovation under the California Residential Mortgage Lending Act. Countywide Mortgage Lending is an equal housing lender and proud member of the BBB.
All right. Well, let's talk about some vacations, because vacations are coming up here. This is March, as you said, you know, probably looking at June, July vacations. What about cruising? Well, what about investing in a cruise company? Norwegian Cruise Line Holdings, they reported December quarter loss. The cruise line forecast 12 cents a share profit in March when analysts modeled a loss. Carnival Cruise Lines also reported a loss, but I thought, you know what, maybe there's still some time to get in these, because here's the thing, I love cruising, but I get seasick, so I can't cruise. I think the concept's a great idea, but when you get seasick, it doesn't work. But so let's look at Norwegian Cruise Lines. Their symbol is NCLH, the travel service industry. Wow, the shorts float here is about 10.6%, which gets a little bit worrisome that they think the stock's going to go down. 70% is institutional owned. PE ratio is on the high side, 51.2 versus 28.6. And keep in mind, this is the last 12 months. Chase will give out the forward PE, what you're paying for going forward. So that hopefully is going to be better. Price to sales, 1 versus 2.6. We do see price to book value, 28.3 above the industry at 8.5. Price to cash flow is good, though, 4.3 versus 12.5. Now, they have no earnings over the last 12 months. The industry was up 61.7. Sales for Norwegian Cruise Lines was up 76.5 over the last year. That's very good, above the industry at 28.9. They do not pay a dividend. Looking at their balance sheet, we got a current ratio of only 0.2 versus 1.2. And I remember when we had another cruise line before, something about how they take in the receipts, and therefore it's a liability versus an actual asset. You remember that, Chase?
Yeah. If they sell tickets, those tickets are short-term liabilities until the cruise happens, and then they recognize the revenue. So those ticket sales are, again, short-term liabilities, which really distorts the current ratio. So you'd have to look into that, make sure there's nothing else there. But top of mind here, it's not a problem.
Not a problem. And I don't remember, I don't think it does. I don't think it affects the debt to equity, because the debt to equity for Norwegian is 46.7 versus 2.1. That's a lot of debt in the balance sheet. I'll check that out and look at the other numbers. We do see a net profit margin 1.9 versus 9.5. Return equity, very good, 55.2. We like a 15% or higher. What do you got there, Chase?
Yeah, so looking again at Norwegian Cruise Line Holdings, ticker symbol is NCLH. I see the current price here is $19.99. The 52-week range, wow, the low, $12.15, and the high, $22.75. Did want to go back here. No surprise. I mean, the 10-year return here, it's down about 37%. You see, right before COVID, they were around $60 a share. So, I mean, I don't know if they're going to go back to 60 anytime soon. I'm guessing, like the cruise line that we held, they probably had to do a lot of debt issuance, a lot of stock issuance to get through that difficult time period of COVID. But yeah, I think it getting back to 60, it could take several several years. Looking at the earnings, though, doesn't look bad. I'm going to tell you, going out to December 2025, I do see estimated earnings per share here of $1.71. It gives a target sell price of $28.39, means it trades at about, I'm going to say 11.5 times future earnings. So you get a decent estimated return here, but again, that balance sheet is the big question.
And I did look at those numbers there. And what really destroyed the cruise lines was COVID, because they just could not, well, they couldn't run their business. They couldn't do any cruises. The long-term debt right now on their balance sheet is $12.3 billion. Now, compare that before COVID in 2019. It was half that, at $6 billion. So they are carrying a lot of debt. That means they had to increase their prices. I mean, right now, people are spending a lot on vacationing. What was the target sell price on? I don't think it's even close, was it?
No, it's a good estimate here, $28.39.
Okay, but it's just we don't like to buy high debt companies, because what if something does happen?
Oh, yeah. I would say, I mean, the numbers look great until you get to the balance sheet, and then it's a deal breaker. I mean, you just can't do it. And the big thing I would want to know is, when is that debt coming due? Because all of a sudden it's like, oh, things are great, and debt comes due in, let's say, 7 years, and all of a sudden they have a 2% interest rate, 4% interest rate, whatever it is, and now you got to refinance at 8%, a huge debt load. Maybe you can do it, but all of a sudden your earnings are going to be decimated. It's just something that, with a debt burden that high, there's a lot of other stocks out there. It's not worth the risk, in my opinion.
It is very risky. And I remember we did hold Carnival Cruise Lines, and when we bought it, they had earnings every single year for, I think, nearly 40 years. But during that time frame, I remember they had a ship that crashed. They had a captain that got drunk and crashed the ship. I mean, these things, Carnival made it through okay at the time. But when you carry this much debt in your balance sheet, something like that could destroy you, because you're so leveraged. And looking at their cash real quick, I'll do that as well. Their cash is only $400 million. So
they might be okay, but I don't want to play that game of, no. You know, I want to own a cruise line. I will tell you, we have some clients that want to buy 100 shares of Carnival Cruise Lines, because it's a great deal, you know? And I mean, you actually break it down, your return's not that bad, because they give you some ship credit. I don't know if Norwegian does the same thing. I've told people, it's like, yeah, I mean, I can't argue with that. And we've actually had some clients that they've made decent money off of it too, on the stock.
And if they lose it, like, oh, that's okay. I still got some nice discounts on the cruise and stuff. But it's just something that we like to, when we invest in a business or an equity, we want to make sure, can this weather a storm? And I think the problem we see with Norwegian, they're great now, they've got the earnings, but I don't think they could weather much of a storm at all, and that could put them on bankruptcy. And it means they would still be around. They would just recapitalize, but the shareholders lose all their money. So you got to be careful when you're investing of things like this.
Yeah, I mean, it's, as you said, with a clean balance sheet, they could weather those downturns, but now all of a sudden they have a slowdown in travel. They have, you know, a ship that's down for maintenance, a ship that crashes. I don't know if they could get through that.
Yes, exactly. Well, let's take we got time, I think, to look at Palo Alto. Now, this is one that I think they've come down a lot. I've got to put the symbol in here to take a look at it. Their symbol is PANW, Palo Alto Networks. And at first, when I said, how do they get that symbol? But I kind of see it now. So they're on the software infrastructure. They do have float on the short side, about 4.3, no problem there. Institutional owned 85%, PE ratio 43.5 high, but the industry is at 47.3. Price to sales 13.1 versus 9.4. Price to book value 166.3. The industry is at 157. So these tech companies, no one cares about the book value at the current time. They could in the future. Price to cash flow 32 versus 29. We do see earnings grew over the last year by 8,326%. The industry up 31%. Sales are up 22.3 versus 16. I will point out, how can you grow earnings at 8,000% when your sales only were up 22%? Going forward, the analysts say 5 years, looking for growth in the earnings of 17.8%, about the same as the industry at 17.6. Palo Alto does not pay a dividend. Look at the balance sheet. Current ratio 0.8 versus 1.5. I guess that's okay. Debt to equity 0.5 versus 2.2. That is good. Net profit margin 30.2 versus 21.2. That's a positive. Return on equity 52.3. That's pretty good as well. Chase, what do you got going forward?
Yeah, it's kind of looking here at the chart, kind of looking at some different things. It's interesting. But the current price for Palo Alto Networks, and their ticker symbol PANW, $280.20. I say it's interesting because year-to-date, the stock is down about 5%, but I was like, gosh, I swear I saw a huge move to the downside. After they reported earnings, they did fall to about $261.97. Before earnings, they were at like $366. So they were up around 20-25% to start the year, and then they had that big drop again from 366 all the way down to 261. I mean, it lost $100 essentially of share price in a day. So I'd want to know what the heck happened to those earnings, because that's a massive decline for a one-day move, especially on a company that's got like a market cap around $100 billion. It's not a small business. Looking forward, though, for Palo Alto Networks, I go out to July 2025. I see estimated earnings per share here, $6.18. It gives a target sell price, wow, $102.59. Current price, again, $280.20. I mean, it's
trending. Is it overpriced? I think it's overpriced.
The forward PE is about 50. That's crazy. I stay away. I got to say it real quick. I stay away. Too expensive. Yeah.
Gotcha. I want to talk more on it, but we can't, so I guess I'll have to call the office. Thanks for listening to Smart Investing Show. It is for information purposes only and should not be used as investment advice. If you'd like to discuss in more detail your investment needs, have other investment questions, feel free to call myself, Brent Wilsey, or Chase Wilsey at 858-224-0004. Again, that's 858-224-0004. And listen to that podcast or go to our website. That's at smartinvesting2000.com. That's smartinvesting2000.com. A lot of great information there, like the newsletter. Thanks for listening to Smart Investing Show. We'll be back next week right here on the Smart Investing Show.
I did all that, and may I say,